The following podcast is a production of the Washington College of Law at American University. Any unauthorized use or distribution is strictly prohibited.
Welcome back. This is our panel. This is our panel on cybersecurity and the electronic war on terror. My name is Walter Efros. I teach e-commerce law here as well as some more traditional business law courses. I've been asked to make two administrative announcements. The first is that anyone who paid for registration but did not get a receipt should pick one up at the desk as you leave. Second is that this panel should end around 4:30. There are still books available to be bought right outside near the registration desk. There will be coffee out there as well at the conclusion of this panel. And at 5 o'clock, the keynote banquet will commence in the student lounge. We have a wonderful panel here with us today. I'll just give you a brief sense of what it is. Each of them is going to spend approximately 12 minutes talking about, so we will still have time to have questions among the panelists and to engage your questions. First, we've got Roger Cressy, president of Good Harbor, who advises clients on homeland security, cybersecurity, and counterterrorism issues, talking about cybersecurity and the war on terror. Then we have Orrin Kerr, associate professor at George Washington University Law School, talking about a skeptical view of the role of government in computer security standards, and then discussing surveillance. Finally, we have Dr. Phyllis Schneck, vice president of strategic development at Cipher Trust, Inc., covering messaging security and the role in critical infrastructure protection. Their biographies are more fully set out in the materials you should have received at the registration desk in order to move us all along. I will omit them here, but they are really sparkling, and I encourage you to take a look at all the credentials of our panelists today. Just a few remarks of my own. I had thought this was being distributed to you. I apologize if it's not. If you would like copies of this, please send me an email. You can find my name at efros@efros.com, my website, or you can go to efros@wcl.american.edu to get my email directly. I'd be happy to send you a copy of this. I had several months ago, actually a couple of years ago, written an article on issues of the cyber science fiction, all the good stuff that William Gibson and the rest of that crew were writing, all kinds of wonderful stuff about that. The problem with this cyber science fiction is it used to portray the hero as somebody who was heroically taking on evil corporations. That has sort of shifted now. In fact, I think the best way to see that is the popularity of a growing popularity of a set of novels. The 10th one just came out a month or two ago. I am not an avid reader. It is produced under Tom Clancy's name. It is called NetForce. The first one came out about 5 years ago. If you read the reviews on Amazon, they are, to say the least, scathing. No one is claiming this is good science fiction or good anything, but the focus is on this fictional NetForce, a FBI anti-computer terror group. And of course, it's taken on a sort of a life of its own. It shows a shifting in the emphasis. The hero is no longer the rogue hacker. In these novels, the hero, best-selling as they are, the hero is a group of anti-terrorist computer specialists for the government with paramilitary and military power, as you might suspect from the Tom Clancy name. My point is, in the wake of increasing efforts by groups involved in private companies with the United States government to develop best practices, in fact, just recently there was an Operation Cyber Storm this February conducted by the Department of Homeland Security's National Cybersecurity Division with more than 100 government agencies, private companies, and organizations. Role-playing, modeling, getting a sense of what are the best practices in the industry, how should we respond? I would suggest to you that if you are counseling private companies, you might have some serious issues about being part of that. I think you should be part of it because there's an argument that if you don't, you are not fulfilling your fiduciary duty of care to see what the threats are, how other people are handling them. Problem is, if you are engaged in that type of enterprise, I think you might have some serious questions, and I don't know that these are addressed. I have no deep knowledge of how these war games work. I don't know that they're addressed with regard to, if you're going to participate, if you're going to share information about actual or potential problems you have had with your own security in your bank, in your electric power grid, in whatever it is you run, Is that going to be insulated from discovery if private plaintiffs come after you, if something does go wrong and they're harmed? Is the stuff you hand over to the government or share in these exercises going to be open for public discovery? Another issue would be, if you learn things about your competitors, about the industry, about the government in this exercise, can you turn around and use that either to defend yourself against some, you know, lawsuit brought by an aggrieved customer, or in any other way? Can you make it public, or are you bound not to reveal what, but some or all of what's said in these conferences? Again, I don't know how this plays out, but I'd suggest if you are counseling one of these companies, you take a careful look at this. The third thing is, what about the notes and the records of all the participants here? Could some plaintiff in a lawsuit against the participant in an exercise of this type be able to uncover all those things, or is any or all of them going to be sealed? Again, you might want to know going in what's happening here. Finally, what about the lessons of best practices? Suppose the industry does evolve on its own or in conjunction with the government or both. Best practices, are those voluntary or are those mandatory? If you don't subscribe and they're voluntary, does that automatically put you at more risk of a lawsuit? If you do subscribe and you still are the victim of some problem and someone gets hurt as the result of a security breach on your private end, are you now going to be able to elicit from the best practices material things which you can actually throw up as a defense? Or is the government going to say, no, you cannot, like terrorist profiles for airlines, like drug courier profiles for airlines and for trains, which historically have not been well shared with the general public, and courts generally have upheld this kind of thing. Is it going to be the kind of thing where the government might even deny there is such a thing as a best practice in this area, much less let you actually divulge elements of it to show you were in compliance? Those are issues which I think deserve attention. I'm not trying to discourage people from participating here. I'm just saying that's something I'd think about carefully if I were general counsel of a company offered the chance to participate. I would just point out two other things before turning it over to the panel. The first is the ABA Journal this month, I just got this yesterday, has as a cover story, "Stolen Lives, Victims of Identity Theft. Look for damages from companies that fail to protect their financial information." If they're going to do that with financial information, you can imagine what would happen if some breach of security in a company caused actual physical harm to them. Second, there is a wonderful case I learned in first year torts. I imagine many of you also did. United States, the Carroll Towing Company, 159 F. Second, 169. That's from Judge Hand, the Second Circuit in 1947, talking about how a company should adopt security methods, in this case not high-tech, but about preventing a barge from floating away and hitting something else, by using an algebraic equation. Does the burden of putting those things into effect, the protective methods, is it outweighed by the probability of a loss happening if you don't put those into effect, multiplied by the actual damage such a loss would entail? And the case suggests that there is no necessary industry standard here, that you could find any company liable, even if the rest of the industry was not doing that, taking that security measure. With that, I will turn it over to the panel and try to hold them to 12 minutes each. Our first panelist is Roger Cressy.
Walter, thank you. Let me go through a couple key points here to set things up, and then hopefully we can explain them and talk about them in greater detail during the Q&A. There's a lot of discussion about cyber terrorism whenever we talk about cybersecurity. So if you learn one thing today, that is there's no such thing as cyber terrorism, and that when we focus on cyber terrorism, we get away from the real issues regarding critical infrastructure protection and what we should be doing in terms of securing the internet and securing the key assets within the United States. The reason why there's no cyber terrorism yet is because the terrorist groups have not used the internet as an attack vehicle. What do they use the internet for? They use it to proselytize. Think of the audio tapes, the video tapes, the chat room, the IRCs that are all used for getting the message out. They fundraise, looking to raise additional capital to support their organizations. They disseminate training materials, the jihadi encyclopedias, or other documents like that, so that the network within the terrorist organization is so diffuse now, you have virtual training online. But what they are not doing is using the internet itself to attack. And when I talk about cyber terrorism, that's what I mean. And there's a lot of discussion right now in the public domain that is fundamentally wrong on this point. Now, does that mean that there will never be anything like cyber terrorism? Of course not. It is not that big of a leap to envision organizations or individuals deciding to use the internet as an attack vehicle. It just has not happened yet. So let's keep the term in the right context here. There is interest, though. We need only to look back at the most recent bombing in Indonesia, the Bali bombing. One of the co-conspirators, an imam by the name of Samudra, was arrested, and as he was waiting in jail to go on trial, he decided to write his autobiography, because that's what every jihadi does when they're waiting trial, write the autobiography. And in the last chapter of his autobiography, he talked about hacking and the virtues of hacking, that every good jihadi should learn how to hack. It's their obligation, it's their duty. Now, he knows about as much about hacking as, say, I do. But the fact that an imam, a leading jihadist in Indonesia, called out cyber crime, in this case, in terms of the hacking he described, as something every jihadi should undertake, is significant. So you use that as a departure point to think there are elements within this global network right now that may look to the internet and use it in a way that has not been used before, but certainly could be down the road. When you look at the threats right now, there really is a spectrum. And the spectrum goes from the criminal elements, individuals as well as organizations, through terrorist groups to nation states, all of whom view the internet as a key enabler at the very least. And what are they doing? They're all doing the same thing in one fundamental respect. They're exploiting the existing vulnerabilities that are there. So therefore, if you eliminate a vast majority of these vulnerabilities or implement steps to mitigate the risk, therefore you're eliminating the capability of the spectrum to undertake attacks against a nation state, against an enterprise, and against individuals. There's the short-term requirement, which we still have not done a very good job at, of eliminating the vulnerabilities that exist today, and the longer-term requirement of how do we put in place policies and procedures to prevent new vulnerabilities from being created. This is not to say you can eliminate all of them, but we need to do a much better job. Because when we talk about cybersecurity, we talk about the threats that come from terrorism in general, what we're really talking about is risk management. How much risk are you willing to accept as a nation, as a company, an enterprise, and as an individual? Your level of risk and what you agree it should be therefore will dictate the type of steps you take to manage it. Every element of the war on terrorism right now, at its heart, is about risk management. Every step we talk about right now in terms of cybersecurity is about risk management at a basic level. So understanding the risk, identifying it, framing it, and then you can come up with a path as to how you should deal with it. There are still opportunities within the internet for serious attacks, serious exploitation of these vulnerabilities. And the greatest concern that I had when I was still at the White House was going after the fundamental architecture of the internet, the border gateway protocols, the domain name system, the routers, the backbone routers that form the basis for how the internet works today. Fundamental vulnerabilities still exist there that have not been dealt with. So if the vulnerabilities are there, why haven't they been taken advantage of yet? A very interesting question to which I do not have the answer. But it's the dog that hasn't barked, and let's keep it that way for the time being. Let me turn quickly to the United States government and what their role is in all this. As much as I love my friends still in government, the administration has been pretty much asleep at the switch on cybersecurity since the beginning. We've had 3+ years now the Department of Homeland Security, and we've not had a realistic and reasonable approach on cybersecurity. It's been over 6 months since the position of Assistant Secretary for Cybersecurity was announced, and while we may be getting close to finally filling it, there has been a serious gap in leadership. What I tell my clients around the country, my corporate clients, is that Washington does not care about cybersecurity, and therefore you should draw one central lesson. Do not rely on the government to solve these problems. It is your obligation to do it yourself. partly through a fiduciary responsibility, as Walter mentioned, but partly through the basic obligation that you have of managing and operating a large-scale business, or in the case of critical infrastructure, a utility. Do it yourself. Do not rely on government to do it for you, because they will not. What we've seen with the Department of Homeland Security to this point is that it is reactive in nature. And that, by the way, is the function of every bureaucracy. Bureaucracy is reactive. But for all intents and purposes, they're still worried about fighting the last attack, preventing the last attack. And that's just the mindset that we have in Washington. And that's bipartisan. That's both Republican and Democrat here. So I'm not calling out one side or the other. So if that's the case, if our government is reactive, what should we be doing to be more proactive? And this gets to the case of how do we deal with cybersecurity when you're not going to have true leadership from a Washington perspective. It comes to the owners and operators of critical infrastructure. It comes to the vendors within cyberspace. What should they be doing in terms of developing better products? One particular issue is, how should we be dealing with the source code that is written that is driving these new platforms? What type of attention should be paid to it, not just by the company, but what should the government role be in it, if any? It's an important question, and it's one that people have grappled with for a long time. Should a software company be held liable for the vulnerabilities that exist in the software platforms they produce? If a car manufacturer creates a faulty product, that product is recalled. If that product is not recalled but involved in an accident, are they liable for any death or injury? It's a bit of a stretch compared to cybersecurity, but the principle is somewhat the same. So keep that point in mind. So how to address the vulnerabilities today and deal with the potential for new ones down the road? Well, I mentioned better source code writing. I think that's absolutely critical at the very tactical level. The broader step that can be taken is one of information exchange between the public and private partnership. And this is where the rubber meets the road in many respects. Up to now, there has been criticism that it's been a one-way exchange of information. The government has asked for information from the private sector, but not given enough in return. Whether or not that is true is irrelevant. It's the perception that it is true by most elements of the private sector. So this becomes a question of trust. How do we improve information sharing on our cybersecurity and therefore on our critical infrastructure protection so that the government gets the information that they need to do their job, and yet the owners and operators of our critical infrastructure are assured the government is taking the steps necessary to better protect them within the context of what they are able to do. Finding that balance has been elusive over the past couple of years, despite the efforts of people like Phyllis and others who try to do the right thing. There is a cultural gap here that has not been fixed, and we need the department to do a better job on that. Walter mentioned the issue of standards. I think this is a very important discussion to take place as well. What best practices should be adopted? Does it have to be voluntary? Should it be mandatory? Should the government regulate some best practices in critical infrastructure, some of which they're doing right now? Should there be more, and should it be more aggressive? And what is the enforcement mechanism that should be put in place to ensure these best practices, these standards are adopted and implemented throughout the critical infrastructure verticals? Again, a question that we've danced around in Washington, and we do not have a good answer to. Now, I'll tell you when it's going to happen, when you'll see this tremendous movement of government action by Congress, by the executive branch. It'll be after we have a major cyber event. Not cyber terrorism, but a cyber event. Because the reactive nature of Washington dictates that things only get done in terms of how critical infrastructure should be dealt with, how new and more aggressive forms of regulatory action or better security should be implemented. It happens after an event. So the challenge for all of us now is to figure out how can we take steps now that are proactive before the event and not repeat the mistakes of the past? And on that uplifting note, thank you very much.
Thank you, Roger. Professor Kerr.
Thank you. Thank you. I was delighted to receive the invitation to speak here today.
To give you some idea of my background, I was a trial lawyer at the Justice Department from 1998 to 2001 in a section in the criminal division known as the Computer Crime and Intellectual Property Section, and I spent some amount of my time doing critical infrastructure protection work, but most of my time doing internet surveillance law, and so perhaps unsurprisingly, what I'm going to talk about now is first briefly touch on critical infrastructure protection, and then spend most of my time talking about internet surveillance law, a little bit of a return to what I used to do. I left the Justice Department in 2001 and have been teaching since then, so I will be sure to throw in some theoretical asides and cite some French philosophers along the way. I don't really know any French philosophy, which I suppose reflects my DOJ roots even now. First I wanted to talk on the question of the role of the government in computer security. You know, it's really interesting, this whole idea of critical infrastructure protection is a fascinating one. I mean, think of questions like the electric power grid or the source of water, the water supply. For the most part, those are things you're oblivious to, right? You don't think about, you know, I wonder how the power grid's working today. Or, gosh, I wonder how the water levels are right now. How is the water being filtered correctly? These are just things you don't worry about. Somebody else is worrying about them. Computer security is different. Computer security is probably something you do worry about. You might have an antivirus checker, some sort of update. You're receiving regular updates from Microsoft with patches for this and that software. You're getting, you know, probably 60% of the email you receive is some kind of scam or some sort of virus. You're aware of the problem of computer security. And I think the fact that you probably think about computer security as a user and don't think about the water supply and the electric and the power grid reveals a pretty important difference between those two that are missed when we group it all together as critical infrastructure protection. Critical infrastructure protection, when we include computer security in that, tends to bring in almost everything. So anytime anyone connects any computer to the internet, which is probably something you do every day, that is potentially an infrastructure protection question. What's the role of government in that? I tend to think the reason why the government hasn't done much in this area is that there's really not that much the government can do in this area. To regulate computer security means regulating something you do every day. It's one thing to regulate the power grid. It's another thing to regulate the water supply. That's not something that means regulating 300 million Americans. But regulating computer security really is a much broader challenge. And it's a broader challenge given technologies that are, of course, constantly changing. Most of us have computers, and they're general-purpose computers that can be programmed to do anything, and every month or every few months we get a new program that does something else. It's an incredibly complicated machine, and we each have one. Regulating that, I think, is not something that the government is terribly well-equipped to deal with. So the fact that, for example, the Department of Homeland Security hasn't been exactly on the ball with computer security questions, I don't think we should really expect them to do much, and it's not clear to me what they could do, even if they took it on as a high priority. This isn't something that I think where government can really offer much of a solution, even if the government promulgates best standards, some sort of high-level advice. It's unclear how that high-level advice ends up turning into any actual change in terms of the products we receive or the services we receive. So I'm skeptical generally when I hear infrastructure protection and computer together. I tend to think, I'm skeptical that what I hear is going to end up actually changing computers that we use and computer security on a day-to-day basis. Important problem, just not clear to me. It's a government problem, first and foremost. And the second side of things that I want to talk about is the surveillance side. So when we talk about questions of cybersecurity and the role of the internet in the war on terror generally, most of the questions end up being about surveillance. So imagine everybody has these computers all around the world, and people are communicating back and forth, meaning that the government has a very strong interest in watching bad people to find out what the bad people are doing. And the question is, what legal rules should regulate access to those communications? Right now, our legal system is largely something that follows from the telephone network. So the sort of first generation of laws here, depending on how you date them, could be starting in 68 or 78 or 86, were mostly tied to this notion of there are contents of communications, telephone calls, and those are very private. And then there's some other stuff, say the numbers dialed from a telephone call, and that's not terribly private. And the law basically focuses on the nature of those communications and the interception of the communication as the legally important event, requiring the government to obtain court orders, requiring some sort of showing in order to intercept, to actually collect the contents of communications and then a lower court order for non-content information. And I think the interesting question is, does that basic framework sustain itself over time? That made a lot of sense in the telephone network, because telephones, by their nature, are ways of communicating human speech. So one person calls another person, and they speak on the phone, and what the communication itself are its contents, it's what's spoken. And then there's some information generated about the call, when it was made, what phone numbers were, and the like. But that's pretty much all the information that's out there. Switch to the modern computer networks and the Internet. There's so much more information out there. First, the content-non-content distinction doesn't seem to entirely capture the possible information that could be collected. So sure, there will be contents of communications like the contents of emails, actual communications. But there's lots of other information that maybe counts as contents, maybe doesn't count as contents. The difference being that people use computers to do so much more than people use the telephone network to do. Again, telephone network is really just communicating speech. Computers, the Internet is, think of all the things you do online, whether it's surfing the web, sending other communications, various servers, functions you use, whether you're programming, sending computer commands, or just sending email, surfing the net. There's so many different things you do. There's lots of communications out there. Another big difference is that the way the communications are sent, everything's broken down into packets. This is, of course, super simplified, but let's go with it for now. Everything's broken down into packets, scrambled together, and shipped across the network. So if anyone is trying to pick up a single communication, they need to screen a very large group of communications and find the pieces, the packets, and then reassemble those packets into the original communications. It's no longer possible to do kind of a surgical attack. Only wiretap the bad guy's telephone, home phone by going outside the person's home and tapping into their calls. Now there's much more of a broader screening, filtering that might occur at the ISP or somewhere else, actually screening in all of those communications and just filtering some of them. And this, the change in technology really creates the potential for a significant shift in how the privacy laws might work. So in a classic physical search, just sort of imagine 100 years ago the police want to break into a home, want to investigate a crime or investigate a suspected terrorist act, they would be breaking in which case the human observation goes with the privacy invasion. And now we have the possibility of, for example, copying lots of communications but never seeing them. Imagine if we could copy lots and lots of communications, everybody's email. Imagine the government, were creating a copy of everybody's email and holding them but not looking at them. Would that be a privacy invasion? Is the fact of the copying something that the law should regulate, or should the copying itself be allowed? So the next step in turning, going from the copying to the actual use of a communication would be some sort of filtering. Should the filtering itself be what's regulated? Should the government be allowed to copy a great deal but only filter a little bit, or filter only under certain conditions? Finally, we might go from the filtering to disclosure. So going back to the the wiretapping law in the 1930s, following the Communications Act of 1934, the wiretap law at the time was understood to allow the tapping, but not allow the disclosure of the tapping, but to allow the fruits of the tapping. And again, that sort of breaks down, the law would then pick a different stage to regulate. Effectively, the law ends up regulating the disclosure and not the tap. And with internet technologies, we have the ability to once again change the ways in which to figure out what the law is regulating. Current law primarily regulates the interception now, the actual collection of the evidence that's regulated. Internet technologies allow us to draw a different line, and we have the ability to draw that line differently. And I think one of the big questions we need to answer is whether we should change where the line is drawn. And again, that sort of ties into the question of computer security, because it ultimately goes to the question of what's the role of cooperation between providers and the government. Because one of the nature of the network is that any particular provider, even any individual, is potentially controlling an access point where the government might want to install a surveillance device. So lots of individuals become potential cooperators with government investigations, and the role of computer security ends up incorporating both the question of intrusions, hacking, and also providers cooperating with surveillance techniques. Thank you.
Thank you, Professor Kerr. Dr. Schneck.
Good afternoon. I want to thank the American University College of Law and Michael and everybody who did all that follow-up for 3 months getting us all here. Thanks very much for having us. I'm actually waiting for the projector. They showed me which button. As a good little geek, I bought a PowerPoint, and I hope it won't put you to sleep. They showed me the button. The button's not here. Go ahead with it. I actually wear two hats. I'm an executive at an information security company based near Atlanta, and we look at messaging security. One of the things I want to talk about in this context, and I'll preface this with, I am not a lawyer. I'm going to be one of two people in this room that is not. So I don't understand the legal background of everything I'm going to say, but I want to look at today one piece of a very solid part of where business and government are communicating right now. And I'm going to call that messaging, and I'll talk about it. It's not email, it's general messaging. The other hat I wear is as the national chairman of the board of the FBI's InfraGuard program. How many people have heard of that? I got two. So InfraGuard is it's a program housed in the cyber division of the FBI. It goes across all critical infrastructure sectors. Critical infrastructure being anything from power, energy, emergency services, water, utilities, anything. And cyber is one. It also is the nexus of all the critical infrastructure. Cyber runs through every single one. What InfraGuard's about is engaging the private sector. We've got 15,000 people now, everyone from the CEO level to the person working the water tap, to basically pool subject matter expertise. We tried information sharing. That didn't work so well. Thank you, I think. Wonderful. So we tried information sharing. The myth on information sharing, and Roger alluded to this very, very well, is that we in the private sector thought that the FBI and everybody else in government was going to send us secrets. And they sent us, and we got our InfraGuard membership. Everybody's vetted. You're backgrounded by the FBI. You come in. You engage as private sector to work at the state, local, and federal level to build bridges, to share expertise. You get a piece of software labeled secret agent software, what are you going to expect? So these are the same people, by the way, that named Carnivore. So 4 years down the road, we've shifted what we want from information sharing. And what it means is bringing expertise like that in this room to the government, first at the local level, because when something happens in the community, where's your reaction? It's right there. Then up to the state level, and then pull it up with whatever's going on, or to Roger's very good point, what's not going on at the federal level. So I come wearing that hat as well as the other one. Also today, I'm the big V, I'm the vendor, but I'm not here to sell anything, just to talk about what we see in the industry. Generally, this is the picture that most people think of when they think of cybersecurity. Oh my goodness, my computer fried. That's not the concern. The concern with cybersecurity is with the critical infrastructures, because whether I hack your computer or I send you a piece of mail you don't want, it's that something I own ended up on something you own. And if you think about it, to Oren's point before, if you think about how cyber runs the critical control systems, the supervisory control and data acquisition, or SCADA, systems that run all of our utilities and all the things to keep that light on. When a vulnerability comes in there, something I wanted to execute on something you didn't intend me to do it, that's a vulnerability. That's why we look at this. I'm going to pick on messaging today for two reasons. One is basically that's how we all communicate. Whether it's an email or whether it's instant message, that's how a lot of business communication, government communication is happening. Second reason is I'm probably closest to it than any other form of internet traffic right now because I do it 24/7 when I'm not doing InfraGuard. So when I look at the messaging spectrum, email, I send you a message. If you like me, it comes back. If you don't, it doesn't. There's no expectation. All the way at the other end, voice over IP, it's merging. Right now, we have regular landline phone calls. Pretty soon, you can make that all digital. In some states, they already have that. In the middle, how many people have ever used instant message? That's kind of the middle ground. You set up a session, you're talking, but there really isn't an expectation it's going to come back. The vulnerability here is it's all coming together. So sometimes they'll be writing an email. Again, I'm not a lawyer, but I'll notice it's too sensitive for an email. I'll skip the email. I'll pick up the phone. I'll make a call. I have a weird perception that that makes it more private. Well, it doesn't. Because with voice over IP, that's the same as my sending an email. It's just data. And the one thing I would disagree with the talk before, with the packets, I can collect a bunch of packets, intercept a conversation, and probably make sense of it. So if the people are out there that can combine the inner nerd with the ability to do harm, then you look at the merging of communications, and it's just data. It just fits on a wire. Bring that back to critical infrastructure protection. My data is on your machine. That's the problem that we have. And to Roger's point, it's getting on your machine, and I'll show you how in a minute, because of known vulnerabilities that we could pretty much patch today. So when it goes back to leadership, we need something, a position, a tropical fish, or something up to at least set an example on national cybersecurity policy. If they do nothing else, they need to show that it's important to at least do the very basics. Very quickly, my background, I grew up in the Cypher Trust world in spam. Basically, these people get up in the morning. Why do they do this? They put on their furry slippers. They don't have to go to work. They send a few hundred thousand emails. These people are making $2 million a year to send garbage mail to your mailbox. Why is this a vulnerability? It's a sign that I can get something to your machine. In a few minutes, I'll show you what the bigger vulnerability is. It's both technical and it's social. When I get you to react, I now have information from you. When I look at how to guard and how to protect, this is just messaging, not even all of IT. It's just the messaging piece. First, you have to look at what goes in and what comes out. All the compliance, that's making a lot of computer security companies pretty rich right now. How to protect what goes out, what terms can't go out, what stuff can come in. But you also, with the merging of all these different protocols, whether it's phone and web, all of it coming together as it sits on a wire, and by the way, to the point of critical infrastructure dependency, your power can come in on the same wire. The technology is there, it's just a different frequency. So merging all of this together to protect it from other people's intentions, executing themselves on stuff that you own and stuff that controls our infrastructure, you have to guard all those inbound and outbound threats on all the different protocols. And not just at the gateway, not just at the desk, but everywhere in the middle, because they're all different threats. Growing up, I wasn't allowed to drive Dad's car on the weekend until I cleaned the pool. That pool had 90 different filters, and the smaller and more disgusting the bug, the more inner the filter was. It's the same thing in computer security. You got the big filters on the gateway, the tiny filters on the desktop, but everything in the middle is going to catch stuff, and you have to clean them all. And again, this really isn't rocket science. The technology is there, but we as a country have not been focused, and we as a private sector have not been focused on just implementing it all and looking at it as a risk equation. It's been looked at as viruses and worms and things that the geeks in us will take care of, but really it's gotten so far. There's so much cyber running so much of our real world that we all actually have to sit down and look at the risk and take the lead and figure out how to secure that. I can talk to people after about the data stores we have. I bring this up because when you look at, for example, in my background, in our company, we see about 100 million messages a day. It brings up privacy issues. It brings up issues of what we're seeing. Do we see content? Who lets us see that content? How do you protect it? And how do you take all that content and allow it to make your appliances smarter to protect all of your clients without ever revealing any private data? And these are the things that computer security experts are now working with lawyers on today. So I bring it back to critical infrastructure, but one of the key things that I get asked about day in and day out, how many people have heard of phishing? Everybody got an email from your bank? What's actually happening there, and to one of the talks we heard in the earlier panels, and two things. One is there's a bunch of numbers. the numbers are finally getting high enough, and it's because of the identity theft, not because of the phishing itself, for federal agencies to notice it. Before that, the numbers were actually too small for them to care. But the big thing is the reputation. People's brand names are out there. You're getting ridiculous email with somebody's brand name on it, and that makes that company less reputable. And that's a bigger cost to them than any amount of dollars. So when I look at how good they're getting, I know it's hard to see, but even the educated users are getting trapped by this. The older sort of technology that can try to trap this stuff looks at words in the email, probabilities of words coming together. They look at it, they used to think they could figure out is that a phishing email or not. This one came in as an image. There's no content filter in the world that's going to be able to look at those words. It's a picture. And even better, the link that makes it look real, you'd look at it and say, oh, I know that there's some bad email out there, but this one has my bank name on it. And by the way, this could happen to any bank, and it does. I chose this one. You click that link because you think it's real. Underneath, it's a picture. Underneath that link is a link that went to China. So it took technology to find this. They found it way deep in the header. It did not come from the header it claimed to. That's generally a good source of information that the email was spoofed or not intended for the purpose it looks like. The other thing is if you look at the crazy words at the bottom, those were intended to untrain some artificial intelligence that's in these systems. When they do catch words, they're trained by probability algorithms to look at words that belong together. Like, do you want a new mortgage generally indicates spam these days. These types of random words untrain that. So those words came in as white text on white, so the trained user wouldn't see it. The technology found it. So that's just an example, and this is about 2 years old, of how good these guys are getting. So why we care? When you receive one of these, and again, just think about this back in vulnerabilities in the infrastructure and what's actually happening in the bigger picture. You've received it because somebody that didn't patch a virus, probably a virus or a wormhole that's been known for 3 years, somebody didn't patch it. That machine received code from somebody else. That code said to send 10,000 emails over the next few hours containing that message. They re-gift these things, like fruitcake at the holidays. There's about five or six good ones that they use every so often around the internet because the logos are hard to make. Somebody and a lot of machines that are not protected spam the internet, pardon the pun, with this stuff. Those machines got the code to do that spam and the instructions on where to send it from somebody at a higher level, internet relay channel. And what they're getting these from is somebody at an even higher level that has paid somebody to create this. And on the back end, when you get that, if you're to respond to it, 20 people per attack respond to this stuff. That's our stats. They will take that credit card and they'll do a couple of things with it. One is they'll use it right away and then get rid of it because the bank will figure it out. One is they'll post it on a foreign chat room. People think that Russian is encryption. Okay. And the other thing they'll do is they'll hold it for a while. Or they'll charge you like a $10 or $15 subscription. The longer that goes on, the more valuable you are to them. Because it says you don't read your credit card bills and it says you're good for some credit on the long term. And it's harder for them to get caught years and years after they took the steal of the credit card number. If you go on to one of these chat rooms, we have a research team back home that has people that understand all kinds of languages. You can log on to this. They've shown it to me. There are account numbers floating across, just like an auction. Hey, try this. It works. It's hot. It works for a few minutes. You start to trust the guy. You get engaged in the conversation. And next thing you know, you're buying this stuff from him. The concern is that this is led by basically organized crime. I bring this slide just to show you. This is what it looks like when we logged into one of these. Not that that's a fun slide, but the point here is you have to log in right as the code is running. Not to be too nerdy, but if you get in right then, you can catch the instruction to show where it's going and give that to law enforcement, which goes to my next point, how important it is as the private sector. There may not be a strong strategy yet in government security, but there will someday, to Roger's point, because we do need it. The private sector is a huge part of that. We see this. A lot of times they don't. If we can get to it in time, we can give it to them and tell them where the bad guys are going. Because the structure really does look like something that's probably quite familiar to us in our general history. And the problem is when you get these guys overseas, and I work a lot with, you know, this is where I'm still learning because my experience in bringing up InfraGuard is you got to share this information. You got to make sure it gets to the right hands in government. My experience as an executive in a private sector company that makes revenue is that you can't give out too much information. So how do you do that? How do you give out enough information to do the right thing by the country and the right thing by our customers, but also not violate anything legal? I live in our lawyer's office trying to figure this out, and I'm just one person. You can also look, and I explain this later, you can look at individual hosts on a network, given all the data we see, and see their sending behavior. What happens if this data falls into the wrong hands? What do you do? I have people from the government wanting all the data that we see. I can never do that. But how much of it can you divulge? These are the issues that we have right now. And then bring it back to the context that all that messaging is coming together. Your email is now a phone call. This is what it looks like on a corporate network when one host is getting a zombie. And actually, this is a rare instance where that host had two separate zombies. First, he spammed one group of addresses, and then he spammed another the next day. Working with LE has gotten a lot. That's what it used to be. We have made great progress as a country in working with the FBI, with the Secret Service. We're two different cultures. Understanding how they work is very hard for us at first. Understanding how we work is ridiculous to them. But we have the data. We have the subject matter expertise. They can take these people off the street, and they can end the phishing attacks. The problems we still have were mentioned in the panel before with the extraterritorial issues, because you can catch these guys overseas, but sometimes they get released because we have no jurisdiction to keep them. So we have improved. It's still a long, long process. Every day I get calls from InfraGuard members. We're working on how to combine the per-sector organizations with our all-sector organization, how to work with groups like Rogers, other companies. Because as private sector, we have to tell the government what we want as a policy, because it does not seem that they have the strategy right now to put that in place for us, because they don't know how to do it. We're housing the data, and we have to help them figure out ways to work with us. If there is no way in place, make the one you want. That used to be the Department of Homeland Security. That's the org chart that was put up when they first started. They actually have made a lot of progress. However, there's a lot of work that we need to do. Just understanding which parts of Homeland can do what parts for us, and being able to work that line between knowing the vulnerabilities and how much information you don't want to divulge. It's very, very difficult day to day. How many people have even heard of the National Infrastructure Protection Plan? So this is a plan that's being created right now inside the Preparedness Directorate of the department. It basically is going to cover all the sectors. It's how we do our protection for all of our infrastructure. A lot of groups have had input. A lot didn't, because they didn't know about it. So one thing that I think is going on up there is they're hemorrhaging public confidence, and part of that's because the public is not aware of the efforts that are going on. This plan, every private sector company that wanted to be part of it should have at least known about it. InfraGuard did a joint response with our people. Those 15,000 people, that's a nice cut, but that's not enough. So just as a cyber vulnerability issue, this is because cyber is the nexus of all the infrastructures, because our phone calls are now our emails, because our power is getting delivered on the same line, we as private sector, it's not a terrible situation, it's an opportunity. We have the opportunity now to make those lines, to draw those lines, and to make the policy that will govern us protecting ourselves going forward. So with that, I just leave you the big conclusions. Messaging is central to IT. Your email is becoming your phone call. And we have got to find a way to work with government, if not teach government, how to work with us. So thank you very, very much.
Before we open the floor to questions, I have one for the panelists. I mean, I've gotten progressively more scared listening to the lineup here. I mean, first we've got Roger Cressy telling us that, he tells clients don't rely on the government, do it themselves. Then we got Professor Kerr saying there's not much the government can do. Then we've got Dr. Schneck saying, when the private industry talked to government, they thought they were going to get some secrets coming back, but that didn't happen. So my question to the panelists is, if you are running a company in this age of, again, the topic, I know we've talked to some degree about crime in general, but the topic we're specifically here to discuss is terrorism, how do you protect yourself? What is it? I mean, it's easy to say, well, go hire an expert, or it's easy to say, read the trade, literature, or whatever. But beyond that, what do you tell people who come to you and say, I'm heading up a company, I don't want to be victimized by common or uncommon criminals, I also don't want to be the subject of some kind of terrorist attack or drawn in to one of those. What do I do?
You hire Good Harbor Consulting. We show you what to do.
Well, beyond that.
Beyond that, okay, if you can't afford that. There are a lot of things you can do.
Your rates are very reasonable.
They are, yes, compared to most. There is a lot you can do, and it starts with some of the best practices that you all can find on your own. It starts with managing expectations about what the government can do. And it also starts with putting together a infrastructure within your corporate organization in terms of chief security officer, chief information security officer. Educating people is probably the most important thing. You know, how many of you have a firewall active, antivirus software active? How many of you are doing live updates of your antivirus software so the latest definitions of it are being pushed to your computer? That's the basic stuff. It's like brushing your teeth in the morning. You know, if you're not doing that, not only are your teeth nasty, but you're practicing bad cyber hygiene, okay? Yet there are plenty of people out there who aren't even there yet. So, I mean, the education opportunity here is both huge and also very, very depressing. But before I turn it to Oren, let me say one thing about his point about the government not having a role. You know, the government should have their own version of the Hippocratic Oath, which is do no harm. And more often than not, they do harm, which is why Oren and others believe there is no role there. But let me give you a scenario. Phyllis mentions voice over IP. Great stuff, right? You're all downloading it. You love Skype. It's cheap. It's easy. Piece of cake. A lot of government agencies are looking at VoIP right now. A lot of first responders, both in the police and the fire world, are looking at VoIP. The same threats on the internet today are what you get in VoIP. Denial of service attacks, spam, or in the world of VoIP, spit. And my favorite, vomit, voice over misconfigured internet telephony. So if you're spitting your vomit, welcome to the world of VoIP. Now, the point here, to be honest, that you learned how to say spit and vomit in your symposium today, is that if first responders are deploying VoIP and they do not have the proper security procedures in place, and a smart adversary uses the vulnerabilities inherent in VoIP to drop the E911 system or to cause further problems in both the hospitals, the fire departments, and the police departments, either before or after a physical attack by a terrorist group. I'm going to ask you one question. Who do you think the American people are going to demand answers from? They're going to demand answers from the government. So the government does have a role here. The problem is it's not been properly defined. And the expectations have not been met about what the government should be doing in terms of critical infrastructure protection. Because everything Phyllis said is true. Our nation's critical infrastructure rides on our computer networks now. No one made that decision. It just happened. And we need to do more in focusing on it.
Sorry for the rant. Dr. Schneck, do you have anything to add to that?
I would only add that the longer we wait to set that policy and to get our act in gear, the harder it gets. Going back to the VoIP analogy, you no longer have caller ID. You no longer have any accountability on where the call came from or where it went. You can hide on the internet just like some of these cyber predators.
Okay. Any questions from the floor? If you could step up to the mic just so we can get this on our audio.
So I think part of the problem is it's actually relatively easy to hide in cyberspace. You know, you look at what the FBI is doing in dealing with the cybercrime element of this. When they shut down servers, when they try and wrap up individuals, it turns into a whack-a-mole problem because every time you shut down a server in one location, it pops up in the next one, almost simultaneous. There is a lot being done, both from an IO perspective as well as from an information assurance perspective. So is it enough? You know, like I said, the web is not being used as a tool, as an attack vehicle yet, but it's a spectacularly useful tool for Al-Qaeda in terms of proselytizing, recruitment, and winning the war of ideas against the United States right now. So instead of trying to shut it down, I think the more pertinent question is how do we address and counter the propaganda that they're putting out and counter it in a way that influences the audiences we're looking to influence. That's a more long-term challenge.
Stuff like that. I'll attempt to try to answer part of that. So in the early days, InfraGuard enjoyed a wonderful reputation of the largest group of cyber wonks ever. It was all about patch this and patch that. And we've worked very hard to evolve into an organization that was about cross-sector participation, and not just patches and viruses, but looking at getting experts in so that you know who to call, both government experts as well as private sector experts, when something happens. The other piece of that is when you see something. You know, we, the private sector, are the ones with the frequent flyer miles. We're the eyes and the ears. We see a lot more, we learn a lot more than, from what I've seen anyway, than our government counterparts. So it's our job to bring that to the government people that can actually arrest some of the bad guys. It's also our job to transcend some of the boundaries of competition and call your competitor and say, I saw this. I mean, this does happen, you know, in times of need. So in a community, as a big company, call your competitor with some data. This is happening to you. And get people together willing to do that. That's what InfraGuard, that's what the ISACs, that's what a lot of these other organizations, you know, ASIS, are trying to do. They're bringing people together to pool expertise and be willing to call one another, because when we band together, we teach each other things and we're a much, much harder enemy.
Hi, I'm Don Afflin with BNA's Privacy and Security Law Report. And I go to a lot of conferences, so I appreciate you hearing about Rock and Roll and Amos Microsoft for that morning. Don't you think, in fact, the government has had to do this in terms of consumer protection? The FTC is going after that security and fairness clause, says you have to have reasonable security procedures in place to make customer information secure. But that's the spillover effect of that security in general, including terror protection companies are looking at their bottom line and spending money on data security for the organization to risk, and the FTC has to that.
Yeah, I think that's right. Look, the glass is not completely empty. There has been some progress in a limited fashion. What I think the frustration we all share is that a lot of time has been lost since 9/11 in coming up with a much more comprehensive and executionable cybersecurity strategy. You know, we're going to see congressional action on a national data breach notification law this year. I think I'm betting on that. The more examples we see of your credit card data being lost, of other mistakes where backup data tapes fall off the turnip truck. That is pushing Congress to do a national notification law. I think that's a good thing. I think they should also demand encryption on all databases in a way that is reflective and consistent with each respective industry. But those type of leadership steps have been slow in coming. So, well, I take your point that some things have happened at the consumer level. We are just missing a lot of we're wasting a lot of time. And within that time, there are opportunities that have been missed as well. That's the frustration.
Yeah. I would just add that it's, at least to me, uncertain as an empirical matter as to how much interest in computer security from companies really follows from experience with government standards. So the FTC is you know, promulgating standards with respect to some regulated industries. I don't know if other companies are saying, wow, well, you know, if the FTC is going to be doing this, then we should really join on, as compared to other companies that are worried about losing customers in the market or worried about being sued or what have you. So my sense is that it's still primarily a private sector influences that are pushing that more than government answers.
And I would applaud the FTC effort, especially in the identity theft area. If you go to their website, they have some resources. I mean, it happened to a friend of mine, a little old lady friend of theirs was a victim of identity theft. We went to the FTC page, and there were a decent amount of resources for her that I didn't even know about before then. You know, but I'll also add it's a usability question, right? So companies implement what they can do. They spend the minimal amount of money they can to make the revenue they need. And security is not a profit center. You just spend money, and nobody hears about you until something goes wrong. So unless it's easy or it's required, no company's ever going to spend any money on this. And that's why we have the problem of setting up, you know, the risk equation.
Unless, perhaps, I might add, there might be a sense among some corporate executives now that we could get personally sued, or at a minimum, the company could get sued, and we could be sued in a shareholder lawsuit for allowing loss to be suffered by the company for not taking adequate security steps. So it may not be actively required, but there could be some sense that we might even be personally liable if some hideous thing happens security-wise on our watch, and we weren't responsible and we let it happen.
I think that's right. I think Sarbanes-Oxley has had some impact on this as well, even though Section 404 is very amorphous. And as much as we love beating up Microsoft because they're such an easy target, you know, they have changed some of their procedures in the past several years. One of the reasons why Vista, the new operating system, has taken so long to come to market is because they've spent more time looking at the security element of it, trying to make the source code better, trying to patch potential vulnerabilities before they're introduced into the consumer space. So I give them credit for that, but it's kind of like turning an aircraft carrier in the Potomac River. You know, you're constantly hitting sandbars, you don't have enough room to do it, and as a result, you're always stuck. Now, I think the bigger question here is, you know, if it is just market forces that are driving cybersecurity, will there ever be the type of systematic change that experts like Phyllis and others believe has to happen? Or do you have to wait till after some sort of national event before you get those type of steps? And if you do, then Congress is going to do what they always do. They're going to use a sledgehammer when a scalpel is required. So it was just common sense, I would think, that you do more proactively to prevent that sledgehammer from ever being dropped. But
and I think you could also add that in some ways this resembles Y2K in the sense that, okay, maybe in 1990 nobody was thinking about it, or very few people were, but as the years of that decade progressed, sooner or later, if your CEO was saying, what's Y2K, people were saying, are you crazy? You don't know what that's about? Are we doing anything? So I think there's a sense in which computer security literacy, if you want to put it that way, is now a part of the skill set that every executive should have, at least a sense of there are problems, here's the basic sets of problems, here's what we should be talking about with our tech people. Another article I wrote years ago, and some people remember me most fondly for this, which, you know, I wrote a lot of other stuff I'm prouder of, but if you want to send me an email, I'll be happy to send it to you. For Legal Times, I wrote a review of Nancy Drew. Many of you may not recall, but her father in the old series and in the new books that are being written is a lawyer. Well, in this one, number 144 in the series, you can still get it from Amazon for something, I think, like $4. It's actually a pretty good read. Nancy finds out that her father's law office, the guy is so clueless when it comes to cyberspace that he's letting his own associates purloin data, and Nancy tracks down, as usual, the culprit. Well, I said, you know, if this is appearing in Nancy Drew for preteens, don't you maybe think that practicing lawyers are not going to be able to get away with some argument that I'm not liable for malpractice or anything else because I didn't know there was such a thing as computer security? I don't think so. So I think there is a growing sense of computer security literacy. At least you have to know what the problems are. At least you have to know what phishing is if you're some kind of executive, the PH kind of phishing. Yes?
It's INFRA, INFRAGARD. I didn't name it.
Yeah, the encryption element of it's fascinating. There's another technology being deployed. Phil Zimmerman, who wrote PGP, has just come out with his own version of it for VoIP called ZPhone. And while we love Phil, as I reminded him, in 1999, Al-Qaeda used PGP to encrypt the computer of Khalil Deek, who was involved in the Millennium Plot. And he was picked up in Pakistan and rendered back to Jordan, where that password for his PGP system was ultimately extracted. Now, because I was at the White House and the National Security Council staff at the time, and I was worried about multiple terrorist attacks around our country and the world, I thought that was a good thing, and I still do. But the encryption element of VoIP is very, very serious. I mean, there's a debate going on right now, discussion about how is Kalia going to have to evolve in order to meet the requirements of the VoIP world. And I'm not sure there's a good answer there yet. I don't know if Phyllis or Owen have an idea there, but the encryption capability in the VoIP programs are going to pose a very interesting challenge. for our friends still in government.
But see, it also goes to one of the big lessons I learned, you know, a few years back, there I am trying to sell my first email encryption, my first week with the company. I'm in Toronto explaining all this math to a doctor at a very well-known pediatric hospital in Toronto, and he looked at me, he's three times my age, and he said, young lady, for goodness sake, I am here to heal children. The math is cool, but show me something I can use. It was a really good lesson for me to learn at that point, because you have to make this stuff usable, but he has to use encryption. And if that man is now going to get on the phone, I mean, there is a certain fact that it is harder, unless you're a high school student with a lot of time on your hands, it's harder to hack the common landline than it would be to get into VoIP. There is an issue with how confidential will phone calls be over VoIP, and we do need some sort of confidentiality solution. So I don't know whether it goes back to the old key escrow arguments or whether it goes back to a controlled environment. That's an open debate.
Just a word for those of you who are not aware of this book. There's a wonderful book written actually before 9/11 by a guy named Stephen Levy, L-E-V-Y, who now writes for Newsweek, called Crypto. It's about the rediscovery independently of the NSA by Zimmerman and various other mathematicians, Whitfield Diffie, working privately and independently of the encryption algorithms. And I think personally that Levy does a very creditable job of saying, presenting on the one hand their view that, hey, information should be free, or in this case should not be free, should be encrypted. And on the other hand, he interviews various people from the intelligence community who, of course, have different views. I think he does a fair job of presenting both sides. So Crypto by Stephen Levy, I think a good resource on this issue. Any other questions from the floor? Well, just one final one that I would put to the panel. It's actually a two-part question. The first is, if there's something that you feel you should have said or would like to come out and hasn't been addressed, if you could maybe mention it now. And the second is, if you are in industry and you do have a problem, who is it, or in the words of the famous Ghostbuster tune, who are you going to call? Who is it that you do contact?
I'll let you start with that.
How many people know who I'm told you're supposed to contact? Your local police. Now, the problem we've had is that although many are stepping up and being trained, many local police departments don't have the training to deal with a cyber incident or any type of infrastructure incident. And the biggest attraction to telling anybody that you're a victim or you think you've had a cyber issue is that you look bad. So companies are in this quandary of who do I call, because I don't want this on the front of USA Today. I mean, it brings up some of the issues from earlier. Not to open this can of worms, but FOIA issues. And there are protections with that, so that when you share this type of information, you are protected from public access to that. But at the end of the day, if you look at who you can call, what I would advocate is a colleague. First of all, a trusted, this is all about, Roger said earlier, trust relationships, you know, a colleague company, or the police and or federal resources. But that's why you want to get to be friends with your local FBI field office, your local Secret Service people, and your local police, perhaps, before that happens. And you also want, and lawyers in here can answer this a lot better than I can, because it's still open for debate, but in a lot of cases, when you call the police, that's state record, and that's open, and that's FOIA-able, if that's a word. You call into the FBI under the InfraGuard umbrella, or one of these other umbrellas, or DHS under PCII, and you have some hope at keeping that guarded.
On the question of who to call, the typical advice that I used to give out when I was at DOJ was calling the federal authorities, specifically, typically the FBI, rather than state investigators. And the reason is not that, you know, state investigators aren't wonderful. It's that there are very difficult jurisdictional barriers to investigating computer crimes for state officials, namely that their court orders and warrants don't have binding force outside of their own states or districts. The federal authorities can get a federal warrant, whereas if you're a Nebraska company and you've been hacked in Nebraska, and the attack probably isn't coming from Nebraska, it's probably tracing back to some other state, the Nebraska State Police can't really do very much. There are some things they can do, but not a lot. So typically these cases are investigated at the federal level, and the FBI is the lead investigative agency.
Mark, can I just ask about that? Is it a dumb move to call both? Because then they get in each other's way. I mean, what if somebody says, well, why don't I just place two phone calls? Or then either of them thinks the other one's going to do it, so they don't do anything.
Yeah, I mean, usually there isn't a specific competition problem in terms of trying to get law enforcement attention, and you know, in terms of, well, the other guy might get it, I don't need to bother. But typically state authorities don't have the resources or really aren't set up to investigate these kinds of cases. If we're talking about computer intrusion cases, those are typically ones where the federal authorities are going to have a federal agency, somebody in a field office who does computer intrusion cases who can take a look at it, whereas most state agencies are not going to have that.
This is something the government does well, actually. We should end on that type of note. I have seen a lot. The federal field office agents will come in and work with the company. They'll make sure to the best of their ability that it's not exposed. I'm sure there are limits to that. But they'll work with you with their expertise, with yours, with whatever you need, and they'll make sure that your reputation stays intact and they're more of a partner and they don't come in the window or with the windbreakers.
They do arm the cat, and when the cat is armed, that's a tremendous deterrence.
Okay, well, on behalf of the school, I'd like to thank our panelists. I'd like to thank you all for coming. There is coffee outside, books outside, and the final, the keynote speaker of the day will begin at 5 o'clock, I'm told. Thank you.